In the final days before a federal election, two things happen. First, things get personal.
In those 50 years, I've never seen any public figure as mean or mean-spirited as Peter Dutton.
Do gay people go to hell?
It is not my view that that's the case.
I found it very disappointing that without even prompting, he sought to try and politicise this. People's faith are people's faith, and you know, I'm not running for Pope, I'm running for Prime Minister.
Then, election promises ramp up in an effort to nab those last-minute undecided votes.
$250 million.
$31 billion.
$4 billion plan.
$3.5 billion.
$400 million.
$500
million. For nearly 6 weeks, all parties have been pursuing your vote this Saturday. So for the last time before D-Day, let's break it all down. Who is promising what and why? This is Please Explain. I'm Tori Maguire. Up first, we're going to dissect the major parties' promises with Federal Editor and Canberra Bureau Chief Bevan Shields and Chief Political Correspondent David Crowe, so you know exactly what you are voting for this Saturday. And later on, we'll check in with Senior Economics Writer Jess Irvine and Senior Economics Correspondent Shane Wright, who are overseeing this election's spendometer. With a seat-by-seat battle to play out on Saturday, we'll hear how parties are spending in marginal electorates. Well, David Crowe and Bevan Shields, we're only a couple of days away from the federal election. Are you both still standing up?
Still standing, Tori. Just.
How about you, Bevan?
Still alive? I've actually, just before I came in here, someone corrected me on what day it was. I actually thought it was another day entirely. So it's all blending into one for me, really.
And excellent.
Can I add to that? Because I got a media release from Labor yesterday, or maybe the day before, about their Thursday speech. They were actually referring to their Wednesday speech. So
Excellent. This
is happening across the spectrum.
Well, it sounds like the perfect time to have a really detailed policy discussion with the pair of you. I want to get into the promises this week because people are now, for those probably very few undecided voters, it's crunch time. They've got to make up their mind in the next couple of days. So I want to go through the policies. David, could I start with you by getting you to give me a bit of an overarching view of the difference between what's on offer under the Scott Morrison-led coalition and the Bill Shorten-led Labor Party?
Well, the big picture is, of course, on tax, really, and it is a big gulf between the two sides. And I think it's a bigger gap than we've seen for many elections. On the government side, we've got the commitment to a seven-year tax cut plan that is worth $302 billion over a decade. $302 billion in tax revenue returned to workers over that time. Now, workers have to be patient because some of the tax cuts flow from July 1 this year, but the really big ones come in 2022 or after 2024. This gives rise to the complaint that you've got to wait a couple of elections before you get it. But I think fundamentally, this is the election at which this long-term plan will be decided. And then on the Labor side, we've got a really extensive package of tax changes, not all tax increases, cuts to tax concessions as well, plus the opposition to most of those income tax cuts. So of the $302 billion that the government puts forward, Labor only accepts 60, 70 billion or so of those with its alternative income tax cuts. And at the same time, Labor is going forward with, or going to the election with, about $160 billion in revenue it would raise over a decade from a whole suite of things. Dividend imputation, changes to negative gearing, changes to capital gains tax, changes to trusts, even changes to how much people can deduct when they pay an accountant to do their tax returns, plus some revenue, $6 billion over a decade, from a 2%, what's called a deficit levy, a higher income tax rate on people earning more than $180,000 a year. So that's $160 billion in revenue raised over a decade by Labor, as well as their opposition to the government's income tax cuts. That's the huge gulf between the two sides. We see some fairly humdrum campaigning during this campaign, but we are seeing a really big decision about these major reform questions.
Mm. So, Bevan, the stakes for people who are trying to decide what to do this Saturday are in deciding whether ideologically they think that people should pay more tax and have better funded services, or government should get out of the way and let the economy do its thing, really, isn't it?
That's right. The stakes are high, not just for the leaders around who will get the chance to implement their chance, but the stakes are high in a hip pocket sense for voters, because there are winners and losers on both sides here. Labor is making a very strong pitch around wages, health, childcare, and tax, but at a particular level of the tax spectrum, on income tax. The government is making lots of promises about greater tax cuts over a longer period of time, as David said, but also other various bits and pieces that will actually make a difference to some people as well. So unsurprisingly, each side are going to their corner, targeting certain people. I mean, I think what the really interesting thing out of Saturday, if Labor loses, well, there'll be lots of questions about what does that actually mean about where Australia sits, what Australia believes in terms of reform. I think you can have an argument about whether you love or hate what Labor is proposing, but as an opposition, Labor has promised lots of policies with lots of detail, lots of risky policies. And if that doesn't pay dividends on Saturday, you know, the implications of that for politics going forward are quite severe.
Let's talk about specific policy areas. In an interview with Peter Hartcher this week, Tony Abbott gave this wonderful quote where he was talking about his opponent, Zali Steggall, and saying that a vote for her was a vote for the Labor Party because she wanted action on climate change. And in Tony Abbott's words, the Labor Party has a much better policy on climate change than the Coalition. What is, for our listeners, the difference between the climate policies of the two parties?
The essential difference is about the ambition, the scale of the ambition, which is easily measured because it's the scale of the cuts that either side would make to greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. We've got a 26% cut being proposed by Scott Morrison. We've got a 45% cut being proposed by Bill Shorten and Labor. But it goes beyond that because it's really about policy stability, and it's the obvious weak point for the Coalition because they've been so divided on climate for so long. And really, there's not much more to the government policy than a 26% cut achieved through an emissions reduction fund, their existing mechanism, and their scepticism about how they can achieve it. All the policy detail, there's a debate about whether it's enough, but there is a policy plan put forward from Labor on, first of all, bigger investments in capital infrastructure to spur the use of renewables, build up transmission networks. There's also their endorsement of the National Energy Guarantee to cut emissions, the policy that had the support of the Coalition Party room last year, was then killed off after they got rid of Malcolm Turnbull. Bill Shorten actually says that they would try and get that going again. That's the big dividing line on climate in this election.
Bevan, what's another area where there's a big difference? Because there's been quite a few instances where Labor have just immediately matched government policies, like earlier this week when Scott Morrison announced a guarantee on a portion of home deposits for first home buyers. Labor just immediately just went, yep, sure, that sounds good, we'll do that. What's an area where there's a big difference?
Well, I think wages is, there's a huge divide between the two sides on wages. Bill Shorten is running around out there saying he's going to lift people's pay packets more substantially than the government would. He's promising really a couple of things to make that happen. One is restoring penalty rates that were cut a couple of years ago for hospitality workers. That's something that the government is not proposing to do. He is pushing the Fair Work Commission for a greater than what would otherwise be increase to the minimum wage. Now, he's not putting a dollar figure on that, but he is pushing and pressuring the Fair Work Commission to lift the minimum wage. The government's not doing that. The third part is that he has made a direct intervention into the market by promising to use taxpayer funds to boost the wages of underpaid childcare workers over 8 years. What Labor's proposing is an 8-year phase-in for a 20% increase on the basic pay for childcare workers. The government's appalled by that. The government says there shouldn't be that kind of intervention. Labor is unapologetic about that. They're saying they won't extend it to other industries, but that is a really big gap. We know that wages, stagnant wages growth has been a big political issue in the US. It's now coming here, but I think that is a real divide on a policy sense, as big, if not bigger, than the varying policies on income tax.
What about healthcare, David? Is there a big difference? Bill Shorten started his campaign on the very first weekend making a big pitch on healthcare, didn't he? Has that continued through the campaign?
It has. It's actually been a constant theme for his campaign, and he's come back to it repeatedly through the weeks. And I've been struck by that because I thought there might be a week where they wanted to talk education really solidly for 1 week, but instead they've pretty much come back to health. They are offering more money for health. They have a $2.8 billion health top-up fund, that goes over about 6 years, I think, and it's backloaded. So a lot of that money comes, say, after 3 or 4 years. Now, in addition to that, they basically are sending a message about their willingness to spend more on health over the longer term, and that means that if elected, a Labor government would have to go into negotiations with the states to top up that state hospital funding. There's a big difference of opinion, and has been for some time, on the proportion that Canberra contributes to state hospital funding. The states want Canberra to do more, to do 50% of the growth funding, and that is that's something that will have to be on the agenda. It's really an emotional policy appeal as well. Thinking about those income tax cuts, some of those tax cuts may not add up to a huge amount when you look at them by week. Maybe it's $20 a week if you get a $1,000 tax offset per year. But what you're being promised by Labor is that your local hospital will get more money. There'll be an MRI machine. Sometimes the coalition matches that seat by seat, but the big promise from Labor is more money for cancer treatment, things like that. And that is, I think, a very big theme for Labor. The question is whether that overrides the coalition promise on income tax cuts, which is bigger by dollar value.
I want to talk about a huge policy area that's been largely absent from this federal election campaign for the first time in a long time, and that's border security. Bevan, it looked for, in the months preceding the campaign, like border security was going to be an issue in the budget. There was controversy about the government's decision to shut down the newly reopened Christmas Island Detention Centre. And with Scott Morrison's history as being the immigration minister who effectively, as he said, stopped the boats, there was a lot of anticipation that this campaign could be about that, but it's really been absent, hasn't it?
That's right. We actually had some analysis commissioned of this that showed just how big an issue that was in the media over that week and the following week, when the parliament, against the government's wishes, passed a bill that would speed up and make easier medical transfers from Nauru and Manus Island. That disappeared very quickly, and a big reason that disappeared was the Christchurch attack, was a enormous factor there. And it was always, I think it was always going to be a stretch to mount an election campaign on border security, because with leaving aside the whether or not you which side supports medical transfers and doesn't, there's actually not that much difference between both parties on border security. Labor, after a long internal fight, supports turning back boats when it's safe to do so. Labor, like the government, supports offshore detention. Labor, like the government, is happy to send refugees from Nauru and Manus Island to the US and third countries where possible. So there was actually a pretty thin level of difference between the two of them, and I think that would have been very hard for the government to mount a 5 or 6 week campaign on that one issue of whether or not sick people on islands offshore should be able to come to Australia.
I think on that one also, Tory, I think the government has been troubled by the fact that the Peter Dutton involvement in the coup last year has made him a more difficult person to launch a national campaign on an issue. He has been low profile compared to previous campaigns. He's had to fight for his own seat of Dixon. He's less popular outside Queensland and seen as a divisive figure because of the August leadership spill. And that has constrained them. To be honest, I've been surprised that they haven't done a solid week of campaigning on border security. But as Bevan points out, you know, the stated difference between the two sides is very, very narrow. The question really comes down to Bill Shorten saying he will do more to get those refugees or asylum seekers off Manus and Nauru. And on the government side, it really comes down to trust us. We've done this before. Labor's been weak in the past and you can't trust them. On stated policies, they're very similar.
So I'm going to be really nice to you two just this once and not make you give me your prediction for what's going to happen on Saturday night. But what I am going to do is ask you both, when people look back on this election campaign and describe what it was that decided it, what do you think will be the thing that decided it?
You first, David.
Well, I still think that a decisive factor is unity. I think the old saying, disunity is death, is likely to be remembered after this election. If the coalition wins, it'll be winning from a near-death experience because of its own disunity. And if Labor wins, no matter what you think about the policies, it'll be because the coalition became such an easy target through their own division. And I still think that that is the big theme of this election campaign, because ultimately it comes down to the promise of stability and who you trust to run the country. You can argue over individual policies, but that is the big question at the election.
What do you think, Bevan? What will history say about this campaign?
Look, I don't know if it's the deciding factor, but I think it is a really big factor in the seats that are really going to count on election night, and that's climate change. There's been a really big shift in Australia's attitude to climate change because of the drought, because of some pretty severe weather events over summer. A lot of Liberals are saying that this is what's coming through on the booths. They're really worried about that the Liberal Party is seen as not doing enough on climate change. Labor is not shying away from owning that issue. They're running ads on it. They're proud to own it. And I think in those seats that the Liberals really can't afford to lose on Saturday night, if people do a really good, you know, deconstruction of what's happened and what fueled a backlash, I think climate change will be a big part of that.
Well, at some point late on Saturday night, I'll be dragging you two into the podcast studio for a bonus episode of Please Explain. So keep an ear out for that, listeners. And thanks very much, David and Bevan.
Thank you, Tori.
Thank you.
Tony Wright here, Associate Editor and Special Writer. I've worked in journalism for 48 years. I believe the best political coverage in Australia comes from The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. The craft is being able to cut through the spin, because decisions made in the halls of power affect us all. Subscribe today. Support news you can trust.
We've talked about the big ticket items. Now I want to talk about micro pork. So I'm joined by senior economics writer Jessica Irvine, who has brought with her spreadsheets.
Copious amounts of spreadsheets, yes.
And our chief economics correspondent, Shane Wright. Welcome back to the pod, you two, in what is the last week of the federal election campaign.
You can hear the crowd cheering.
Hooray!
Shane, you were on the road for a little bit of it. Were you running?
Of course I was running. I was, in fact, ran one morning in Perth, the next day in Darwin, the next day in Melbourne.
Wow, that is impressive.
I got a few to run up in Darwin when it was about 25, 26 degrees, 90% humidity. We went out in the pitch dark and it felt like running around in a sauna. Gosh, it was humid.
Ooh, well, that's inspirational. I want to talk about micro pork. Let's start with the seat of Corangamite. Shane, can you tell me about what's going on in Corangamite?
There's more mini pigs down there than you could find on an episode of Lego Master, I reckon. It's so much pork, and it's continuing. As we noted that at least 41 promises made by the coalition down there, and this morning, and we're talking here on Wednesday, the Prime Minister is again down there announcing more promises for the beleaguered Sarah Henderson, the sole Victorian Liberal female MP for the Liberal Party. They are literally throwing kitchen sinks at her to try and keep her in that spot.
So, Jess, what are we talking?
Yeah,
exactly. Look, what are they laying on thick for the people of Corangamite?
Yeah, so Shane and I have been doing this really fun task this week of scouring the candidates' Facebook pages, because that's where they're announcing all these little sort of, we're calling it pork barreling. It's just when you go there and you promise, you know, here's $250 for a toilet block, essentially. And I was doing Corangamite and I just couldn't believe how it went on. There was the announcements sort of go like this: new board and ski racks for the Ocean Grove Surf Lifesaving Club. $135,000. The next day, new solar panels and LED lights for the football club in Leopold. The next day, Point Lonsdale Surf Club life-saving for their new clubhouse. Lights at the Recreation Reserve for the junior football club in Leithbridge. New toilets, community pavilion and playground sail shade. So that's the holy trinity of pork, is if you get a toilet and a community pavilion and a shade for your playground in St. Leonard's. And it just sort of went on, and the candidates are, I find it abhorrent that our taxpayer money is being spent in this way, sort of funneled essentially as election bribes for local, you know, that local candidates are handing out. But the candidates themselves are very proud to be able to fight for their local community. I've been fighting to get this toilet block for St. Leonard's. I'm your local candidate. Vote for me. You're going to get a toilet block from me and not from the other guy. It sort of alarms me that this is the nature of the debate, or that elections can be fought at that micro level. And
so
they are.
This is just, I just want to check, this is a federal election campaign, right?
Yeah, it's these aren't local mayors.
Most of us have a broad understanding of the three tiers of government, including voters. These sound like local council promises. Where in the budget are these coming from?
Yeah, so over the years, both sides of politics have created, Jess and I might call them slush funds. Hollow logs. Politicians might call these in stronger community funds or community development funds. And that's it. They've put away this cash. And it is astounding just how desperate the toilet needs are of voters in marginal seats, because you don't see these things. And look, Jess missed the Cairns for the Winchelsea RSL. They're getting extra money so they can build a couple more memorial Cairns. People in non-marginal seats must be wondering, my goodness, I'm going to need an extra roll of toilet paper to hold on, waiting for someone to come along with some money for myself. Now, we've had a real crack at Scott Morrison and Sarah Henderson. The Labor Party, they know a bit of pork when they see it as well. Like, they get the whiff of bacon. And in this case, just today, they've announced $20 million to upgrade Cadinia Park. Now, Cadinia Park, home of the Geelong Cats, is in the seat of Corio. But guess who's there? The Labor candidate for Corangamite, Libby Coker. There to say, this, I'm bringing this to Corangamite. They've also announced they're looking at a plan to possibly make a national park, Bell's Beach, the most famous surfing beach in the country, the Great Ocean Road, and the Otway Ranges. And that's on top of another 14 promises themselves that have been made in Corangamite. So, yep, there's pork and pork, but it's bipartisanship pork in many cases.
Okay. And in your experience, Jess, over the years, you've been doing porkometers for newspapers for a long time. Is this new scale focus on micro issues, or have they always been announcing?
I think it is a growing trend. I remember Labor, when Kevin Rudd was seeking to be elected, they had a Fix the Leaky Pipes Fund or something, and they were going around and sort of announcing. It's something that they've cottoned onto increasingly, I think, in recent years. And I think that the scale of the sort of number of money pots that the coalition government this time has, with the community development grants, the money for sort of local religious organisations, community, there's the sports development grant. I've never seen it sort of rolled out in such an orchestrated and strategic way. And you wonder, do they know something that we don't know, that people are actually maybe more localised in their thinking, that there is this sort of...
Maybe people don't know the difference between the three tiers of government.
They don't, yeah. And they think, yippee, someone's offering me this money, but wait a minute, I had to pay taxes and I had to send that money all the way to Canberra only to have it handed back to me. You know, and some of these projects are probably worthy things, but they should be funded by local council fees, and that if they're worthy, they should have been funded maybe 2 years ago when we weren't right on the eve of an election, you know, they might still be worthy things, you know, in 2 years' time. Why, coincidentally, do they get announced right on the eve of an election? It's not the way you make good decisions.
Do you have any sense of how these things actually come about? Is there a process? Like, if you run the local bocce club...
Yeah.
Is there a place where you can go and put your hand up and go, excuse me?
Well, it is funny, following the Facebook pages of all the candidates, particularly coalition candidates, back in sort of January, February, they all put the call out and said, the Morrison government has announced this new community sports fund. Let us know what your projects are. Then there's a YouTube clip the next day. I'm your local member out there. I'm going to fight for funds for your football club. Lo and behold, 2 months later, 3 months when we're in the election campaign, I have successfully fought for the funds for the local football club, netball, tennis courts, you know, and here you are. It's quite orchestrated and it's quite
It's a formula, isn't it?
I was going to say, we had an example where they got ahead of themselves. This was a couple of environment grants that the program hadn't been opened yet, and yet you had the Liberal member for Dunkley announcing he'd successfully, and he'd created files for Facebook. I've got successful funding for these environment programs. There's Melissa Price, spotted in her natural environment, like no one else has seen her since. And yet the program hadn't even started. No one could apply for the grants. This is how dodgy it is. And the other most egregious example is the car parking construction funds that are going on. Labor started this last year. They created a fund of about 300 mil. Absolutely ripped off by the coalition in the budget. And now we had the situation 2-3 weeks ago where 25 railway station car parks were announced for Melbourne. 22 of them happened to appear in the eastern suburbs in Liberal Party held seats, including one such as Ringwood, where the project that's being proposed can't physically be built. They cannot build an extra car park at Ringwood Railway Station, and yet that's been promised. That tells you, like, someone in the local seat, that's Michael Sukkar's seat, for instance, has said, how about we have more car parking at Ringwood Station? What a great idea. No one has discussed it outside the MP's office and the minister's office.
Have they put a price on what they're prepared to spend on this magical car park?
In that one, it's about 12 to 20 million, but the Victorian, the Victorian state government immediately says, and it's their property, they're saying, like, and you actually look at this Ringwood Station, it's the current car park is two cars wide, effectively, and it's right on the railway line. You can't go up, it's too narrow. There's nowhere else to go unless you're going to start resuming houses and businesses. So in Deakin, which is a seat where 6% margin, the Libs are really in trouble. There are seven railway stations in the seat. Five of them have been promised railway car park stations, extra car parking. Now, that's like, I'm sorry, I'm going to be ringing the Auditor General next and saying, come on, guys, have a look at what's going on here.
I mean, and it is something that the Auditor General and other bodies have audited in the past, and the Howard government got into trouble for its regional partnerships program doing essentially the same thing. The money goes to marginal seats, and that became known as the regional rorts program. So, Shane, I think it is something we will have to do when the dust settles on the election, to actually go through these, this, particularly the sporting grants and, you know, the community grants, and do the analysis of where did the money go? Did it go evenly to all Australians, or did you just win the lottery if you happened to be in a marginal seat for that election? And I'm fairly confident that it will show quite a depressing thing that that is where the money is going.
Right. Shane, can you just tell me about bees for a minute?
Right. Like every election campaign, I look for some of the more obscure, strange promises. This one's from the coalition. Now, I'm not sure if Tori and Jess are aware of the global bee crisis that we have in terms of...
Oh, yeah.
Very well known.
Very across it.
Very much across it. That bees are our best friends when it comes to agriculture in terms of the free pollination that they provide. Anyway, the Scott Morrison announced $1.5 million for bees, not for research into the demise of bees that is going around the world. No, it is to promote the importance of bees to agriculture.
Right.
Now, I think there's a beggar's belief that we have to spend money on ads to people saying, don't kill the bees, okay, when we actually need to find out what the hell is killing the bees. We're not actually sure whether it's a pesticide use or the way that we've changed biodiversity right across the globe. Like, we're talking intercontinental changes. But no, Australian voters have been wooed with $1.5 million for a bee advertising campaign.
Right. And I imagine it's more targeted than that there is a select group of beekeepers in a marginal seat somewhere who have
the
been
power
presented
the apriest
a vote. Check.
Yeah, the apriest vote. Look out.
Part of the bee industrial complex.
Exactly. And let's not forget the crazy ants. The budget contained a lot of money to curtail the spread of yellow crazy ants as well. And there was another type of ant that's a problem, but I suspect it's only a problem in a marginal seat somewhere.
But no advertising. But about crazy ants, be aware.
I don't know whether you two live in marginal seats or not, but I would like you right now to make your pitch for your micro pork. What micro pork would you like to be delivered to you in advance of this weekend's election?
Look out.
You can ask for anything.
Oh, look, I just think that there's a crying need for the mums and dads of Australia who are taking their kids to the local park and your kid suddenly needs to go to the toilet. And the Jessica Irvine government, we are there for you. We're fighting for you in your corner. There's going to be a toilet block erected down the road. You'll never get caught short again. Don't get shortchanged. Vote for Jessica Irvine.
Excellent. You got my vote.
I'm thinking of the tourism sector, the Kate Bush Museum down here in Canberra. We will bring in guests. Now, early in the year, some of her writing's been put up along the Emily Bronte line through England. We get a huge museum. We'll bring tourists from around the world to suburban Canberra to celebrate everything that's Kate Bush. I only need 20 or 30 mil. That's all I'm asking.
Well, that'll get you through the feasibility study anyway.
Shane is a long-term fan of Kate Bush.
Yes.
I'll vote for you. I'll vote for it.
All right. Well, thanks very much, guys. It's been great talking to you through the campaign. And we will have you back after the election to hold whoever wins to account.
We will.
Jess Irvine is a senior economics writer for the Sydney Morning Herald, and Shane Wright is our senior economics correspondent in Parliament House in Canberra. Thanks to our guests this week, Jess Irvine, Shane Wright, Bevan Shields and David Crow. We'll be doing a Please Explain Extra on election night, so make sure you subscribe to the podcast to get an alert when it drops. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Get full access to all of our election coverage and special events by becoming a subscriber today. Just search Subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. Thanks to the production team behind this week's episode, Nicole Priestell, Rachel Dexter, David Escort and Debbie Harrington. Amelia Maguire does our logistics and planning. David McMillan takes care of all of our recordings and tech. And Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori. Thanks for listening.